You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
It seems to me what's being done is really an attempt to destroy any kind of idea of social welfare within the reality of the only government programs will be things like prisons, the military, and the idea of, again, a social good will become less a reality. So I do think it's really important that we stop the privatization going on.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune and the magazine Tribuno del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of the show. Today's show discusses some of the economic factors that control our lives and dictate many of our choices. We will hear about such topics as the privatization of Social Security, the miseducation of economics in the U.S., and a whole lot about vision. We begin the show with Dollars and Cents magazine contributor, economist, and author of The Raw Deal, How Myths About Deficits, Inflation, and Wealth Impoverish America, Ellen Frank. She spoke to correspondent Tony Zaragoza about her book, The Raw Deal. In their discussion, they talked about the lack of economics education in our country and unemployment. She begins with the inadequate method currently used to calculate the unemployment rate.
Very interesting. It used to be that Dollars and Cents would write articles about how the unemployment rate was calculated, and this was really kind of earth-shaking news. Nobody else was reporting this. But in recent years, I think the mainstream press has really grabbed onto this story, and certainly people like Paul Krugman in the New York Times have increased people's awareness of how inadequate the unemployment figures are. The problem is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which calculates the unemployment rate, defines anybody who has worked for pay at all in the past week as employed. And that means that if you are a migrant worker who got 10 hours of part-time landscaping work and you're not sure that you're going to be able to get full-time work or get work next week, you would still be considered employed. And so that tends to really make the unemployment rate look better than it is, because you're counting all these people as employed who are, in fact, heavily underemployed, significantly underemployed. Then, on the other way in which the Bureau of Labor Statistics makes the unemployment rate sound lower than the actual experience of people who are in the labor market, is that they don't count people who have what they call dropped out of the labor force. And if you stop actively looking for work, if you give up looking because you can't find anything, because you've sent your resume everywhere and nobody's called you back, or you've applied to every store in the neighborhood and, you know, everybody knows you and you can't go around again and again and again, for whatever reason, if you give up looking for a period of time, they will consider you to have dropped out of the labor force and to no longer be an active job seeker, and so you won't be counted as unemployed anymore. And that tends to make the unemployment rate look lower. Now, it is possible, by the way, to find out exactly how many people are not counted for these reasons. The Bureau of Labor Statistics does keep records of this, and you can go to their website and find out how many discouraged workers and people who have left the labor force for economic reasons or are part-time employed for economic reasons. And it's a really significant number. If you added all those people back in, the unemployment rate would be more around 10%. I worked on Wall Street in the early 1980s. The Federal Reserve decided to try to halt inflation by essentially strangling the U.S. economy. And at the same time, Ronald Reagan, who took office in 1980, had a very deliberate agenda to try to weaken unions and reduce the role of government in the economy. So this was a real anti-employment, kind of anti-labor, anti-growth economic policy that was pursued at the very highest levels of the national government in the United States. And one of the consequences of that was that interest rates just soared in the early 1980s. The short-term rate on overnight bank lending, which is now 1.25%, rose to 21% when Volcker was chair of the Fed in the early years. And as interest rates rose and the returns on financial assets rose and inflation fell, then people who had lent money, Wall Street firms and banks, became wealthier. And they started, you know, pouring money into the stock market, stock market investors who had, you know, financial assets started putting pressure on corporate managers to you know, pump up the profits and show high returns on stocks and not just on bonds and bank accounts, that stocks should pay equivalent returns. And so there was a big move in the United States to, you know, pump up profits. It was called the shareholder revolution, and to you know, buy and sell companies to try to increase the share price and lay off workers, downsize, outsource, right size, restructure to try to get your share price going. And at the same time, part of it, as a a tactic to increase their share price and increase their profitability, they cut traditional pension plans and instead put workers into these, what we know as defined contribution plans or 401ks, IRAs, things like that. And that meant that a lot of, you know, ordinary people now suddenly were pouring money into the stock market too. Not large amounts of money, but large amounts of money for them. You know, for somebody who makes $40,000 a year, if you only have $10,000 in savings, and that's in the stock market, then the stock market suddenly looms very large in your mind. And so between 1980 and 2000, the percentage of Americans who own stock rose from about a quarter of the population to about half of the population. And what we started hearing during the early 90s was that the stock market was now democratic. Everybody was a stockholder. You know, the big guys on Wall Street were no different from the little old ladies in Beardstown, Pennsylvania, who were putting their own portfolio together, or the trucker who has a 401k and money in the stock market. They were all the same. We all have the same interest in the stock market. And what we found out in late 2000, you know, the late course, was that this was not true, that we don't all have the same stake in the stock market, that some people have a way bigger stake than others, and they have way more information than others. And as more and more little folks were pouring money into the market, they were figuring out how to get out and turn this stock into cash. And so you had all these scandals of people like Ken Lay at Enron and Gary Winnick at Global Crossing and Phil Anschutz at Quest, who cashed in millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in stock market wealth and left these all these little 401k holders holding the bag.
This is People's Tribune Radio. We just heard from Ellen Frank, author of The Raw Deal, who closed by talking about the hit people's 401k retirement plans took when financiers colluded to sell their Enron stock. This provides a great segue into our next topic, the privatization of Social Security. Member of the faculty at the Evergreen State College and member of the Olympia Movement for Peace and Justice, Peter Bomer, discusses Social Security history and the politics around Social Security reform with correspondent Tony Zaragoza.
It's a long-time dream of conservatives in this country, and perhaps even liberals in this country, to privatize Social Security. Can you talk about what that would mean for people in their daily lives and how it changes what we get out of that system, or what folks who are about to retire would get from that system?
In the Great Depression, the official unemployment rate by the early 1930s reached 25%. One out of every four workers officially was unemployed. A far larger amount were really poor, whether they were working or not. There were large movements. Some even questioned the whole idea of production for profit. And one of the movements was a very strong demand that people, when they're old and retired, they shouldn't be hungry and poor. And the idea of Social Security was you'd pay a proportion of your income, the employer would match that, and that would then go to people who had retired. And that's been the system, you know, ever since the late 1930s, early 1940s. It never provided enough for people to live on, but at least it gave people a floor against, let's say, absolute hunger and super absolute poverty. And the Social Security system, the way it worked was, right, I said, you and your employer paid equal amounts, and it had gone up to about 6% of people's income. So I don't want to glorify the old system, because I think we can do better, but the changes being talked about would basically destroy it. So people paid up to a certain amount of income. Right now it's up to $90,000. That money would go to pay for people who have retired now. It would also go to pay for people who are disabled. You have a large number of people who got Social Security are those who are disabled, or somebody in the family like died and for the children and so on. Okay, and then when I retired, it would come out of money of people who are working now. That's been the basic idea. It's some idea of a community. And the way the payments you would receive, the lower your income, the higher proportion of what you are making you would get. So somebody making $20,000 a year, they would get back on Social Security a much higher proportion of $20,000 than somebody making $70,000. That was the positive part of Social Security. Actually, this whole privatization goes back to Chile when you had the military dictatorship under Pinochet, where they privatized their Social Security system, where the idea of privatization has been that the money, it would still come out of your paycheck, but it would then be managed by various Wall Street financiers who get a cut of it. So that's where I've estimated conservatively, you know, it would start where they'd be making about $1 billion a year of just commissions and would go up. So one thing is the money would be managed by these private Wall Street people who would get a cut on the money that's being made. The second part is it would be your account. You couldn't spend it, but it would be your account. And therefore, when you retired, you would have some say over that money. But the basic idea, again, that we would look out for each other, that the money is not just yours, but it's for the, it's insurance for society as a whole, that would begin to disappear under the proposal. And I guess I'd like to add one thing here. I think this idea of a crisis is a really manufactured crisis in a way that I think we need to be really clear on. Okay, right now, the money being paid to Social Security, the money you pay every year together with your employer, is larger than what's being paid out. Okay, so that's number one. Okay, according to projections, which I think are conservative, it depends on what you think is going to happen, how long people live, growth rates, more money would be taken in until 2018 than even is being spent. The extra money now goes into government bonds, which are totally safe. You know, say the money isn't there, it's false. I mean, government bonds are considered the safest investment. From 2018 to either 2042 or 2052, more would be paid out than would be coming in. But that all that means is that those bonds would be a declining number of bonds. So even using government projections, until 2042 or 2052, depending on who you believe, or the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, there'd be money left there. Afterwards, if there were no changes, their predictions are the Social Security payments would still pay 73%, or roughly three-quarters of what people would be getting otherwise. And that's, when you consider the amount of money, that's a really small amount of money. And the solutions would be so easy, and I think we should even have a better system than now. But just for example, right now, if you make more than $90,000, you only pay tax on your first $90,000. Let's say you said there was no cap, that you would pay, if you made income, you would pay the 6%, no matter what your income. That would take care of well over half of the supposed deficit. Now, this isn't even mentioned by almost any of the stuff I've read. Right now, only wage income is taxed on Social Security. If you also taxed people who made money from profits, capital gain, just playing with paper, not producing anything, if you said that would also be taxed, there's no crisis ever. You could even raise benefits. So it seems to me what's being done is, one, is a way of really paying off kind of the people who manage the money. Two, I think it's really an attempt to really destroy any kind of idea of social welfare. The most positive and popular government program, by destroying that, it'll be easy to go after other programs too, where then the reality of the only government programs will be things like prisons, locking people up, the military will become more of a reality, and the idea of, again, a social good will become less of a reality. So I do think for many, many reasons, it's really important that we stop the privatization going on.
Let's go here. Bush has brought the budget forward to Congress. Dick Cheney, Vice President, was on the talk shows on Sunday saying, well, we're going to have to tighten our belts. There's a lot of programs that we're going to have to cut out of the discretionary budget in terms of domestic programs, and he listed quite a few, but we're going to raise military spending. Now, how are folks to understand that? That we're asked to make sacrifices on one level for the things that people like my parents or my grandparents, my daughter may someday need, while at the same time we're spending more and more on a war of domination in Iraq while people are losing money, right? Halliburton has lost all this money. There's a gap in terms of what Halliburton is charging and what it said it would charge. How do we make sense of that?
Basically, the ideas following is, first, what they did was they cut taxes really significantly on upper-income people. Things called capital gains tax, which overwhelmingly goes to the top of the population. The corporate dividends, those were cut in half. Tax rates on high-income people were cut substantially. Corporate income tax were cut substantially. So you have this huge cut in tax rates, tax collections of the wealthy. I mean, really major, one of the biggest, and probably the biggest in U.S. history in terms of the tax cuts. Many trillions of dollars, many, many more times the so-called projected deficit in Social Security. So you cut this, you cause a huge government deficit, and now what you say is, we have this deficit, we got to cut the social programs. You can't cut the military because we're supposed to be afraid of the Iraqi people. Other, you know, I'm not sure who we're supposed to be afraid of, but using the fear, you have 5% increase in the military budget, and that doesn't include the $80 billion or more that's probably going to come up in a few days for Iraq and Afghanistan. It doesn't include the huge increase in spending for Homeland Security, the large increase for the Justice Department for, quote, going after terrorists. And so then you say we got to cut these programs. But the issue, for example, is saying why not raise taxes back on the wealthy? I mean, they weren't paying enough before, but let's even restore them back. You could increase all these programs rather than getting rid of Amtrak altogether, cutting Medicaid by $6 billion a year. The programs of people who have the least power, those are the ones that are being cut. And I think it's part of this whole thing where first you cut taxes and now you cut this. And the whole thing with Social Security is to show that it has nothing to do with the government budget or so-called deficit in Social Security, which is tiny compared to the deficit because of these tax decreases, is that they don't in any way decrease the deficit in Social Security, which is hardly said. And in today's New York Times, the February the 8th, Paul Krugman mentions that for people who are very young today, he estimates that with the benefit cuts that Bush hasn't said which one, but he estimates people who are like 10 years old and less will be getting about 10% of the income when they retire with the new system. Right now, it's about 35 to 40% of the average you get. So you don't get enough. You could get about a third of what you were making, and it would go down to about 10%, which basically means the end of Social Security. And what's really sad there is it's being played as something to help young people. In fact, young people are the ones who are going to be hurt the most. But it's another one of the divisions I think they're trying to increase, saying, we'll protect older people, but young people are going to help. In fact, they're the ones who are most going to be affected adversely by this attempt to privatize Social Security and cut the benefits of the public program.
You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. Correspondent Tony Zaragoza is speaking with faculty member for the Evergreen State College, Peter Bomer.
What strikes me that we've got to do better than this, that it's not only about saving Social Security, which I think is fundamental for people's immediate needs, but it also has to be about creating something different or finding some other way of doing things. You know, in the meantime, we have reforms, or we at least defend what we have. But are there some long-term visions that we can have that are really about equality and creating a life for people that is beyond mere survival?
I think we have to think in a few steps. Even defending Social Security, it still means, you know, many people are still poor, particularly like for many, many people, you cannot live on Social Security. In some ways, it's a regressive tax. As I mentioned, it's only on the first 90,000. So I think we should say on a second level should be, we should have a system that the money for all people, older people, younger people, there should be some kind of guarantee of a living income. And it should be financed out of general revenue. So a progressive income tax should pay for it. And then people who need the money, it should be for health care, for child care, for when you're retired, that you know you've worked all your life and you should have enough to live with dignity. So that's a second level of saying that we live in a society that has so much potential wealth, it should be distributed fairly enough so that everybody can live with dignity and not have to worry about going to the doctor, they have to give up something else. Beyond that, and this is, I think, the challenge, a lot of people, for example, on the left have been really good in criticizing the forms of economic system we have, the growing inequality, environmental destruction, unemployment, insecurity on a global level, lack of meaningful work. But I think we need to develop more alternatives of a system that's really based around what they used to call Nicaragua and the Sandinista in power, the logic of the majority, a system that would be based on meeting all human needs. And I don't think that can be a system based on corporate capitalism, on production for profit. I think there has to be a system saying, what are human needs? How can we democratically plan? I don't think planning must be bureaucratic or top-down, saying, what are people's needs? How can we live in an environment where people's needs are met that will be sustainable seven generations hence, rather than a system that's always trying to minimize costs, destroying the environment, expanding into other countries, exploiting people all over the world. I do think we have the ability to work together to create a system based on cooperation, based on equality, based on the dignity of all people. And that cannot be, to me, a system based on profits. We do have the potential on a worldwide level to meet people's needs. And I would think of some kind of system, I would call it maybe community work control, where workplaces, thinking about work as an important part of people's lives, would decide, you know, what they can produce, and technology would be used so that people could have meaningful work, develop good products, not for profitability. Communities, individuals and communities say, what do we need? Both social consumption as well as individual consumption. And then there would be a planning method that would match together people's needs as consumers, as workers' needs as producers, until you got a plan that was feasible between production and consumption. The average income in the United States is very high compared to the world, but I don't think, for example, having this different economic system would mean most people in the United States would be poor. I think rather would mean we would really stress other values, values such as community. And one way I think about it is we'd stress social consumption rather than individual consumption. Like maybe like now we have libraries for books, so maybe there'd be libraries for cars. Rather than every individual person having a car, if you wanted to go on some kind of trip, you would have a car that the community would have. You would check it out. And so you would still have all of the needs would be met. Not everybody needs their own lawnmower, you know, but that could be done in a community way. And again, it would be a democratic planning method that would look at matching what the resources are, what people's needs are, what people could produce. I also believe people could work a lot less than now. There'd be sharing of work, rotation of work. You wouldn't have a few people being the executives, other people being the, you know, let's say the sanitation workers. People would do a variety of tasks where they could develop themselves mentally, physically, and spiritually, and there'd be a rotation of work. Income levels would be there'd be a range of incomes, but it'd be very small, and people would know their basic needs would be met because they're part of that community.
For me, it's always important for what does that begin to look like? I don't care what we call it, but to begin thinking about, imagining, aspiring to, and inspiring each other with visions for, you know, different ways that we might do things. And I think those are some really good ideas. Well, Peter, any final words for our listeners in terms of some of the things that we've talked about?
I think right now, you know, there's a lot of cynicism, and we're told just to look out for ourselves, and this whole privatization of Social Security. It's just, you know, the money won't be there. You can't trust anybody else. Just look out for yourself. I think human beings are much more capable of that. I think we're capable of living in harmony with each other and the environment. But I do think it means really challenging this economic system, learning about alternatives, developing alternatives, and also developing organizations and power that can challenge those that be. Social Security didn't come from top. Lincoln didn't free the slaves. It came from movements from below. And I think we need movements below to fight the cynicism and the individualism that we're taught to believe by those in power, that you can't do anything. You can't fight City Hall. I think individually you have very little power. People are wealthy. They have power. They can call up their stockbroker. 10,000 people can lose their jobs. Our power is in our numbers, working together, being visionary, having a vision, having imagination, and putting it into practice.
As we learn, educate, and build movements to recreate the economy and society, it is important to review the basic process of production. Retired auto worker from Detroit, General Baker, speaks to us about the importance of production as we begin to conclude today's show.
To talk about the economy in a popular way is not an easy thing. We face a situation in a revolutionary time. Society is organized around its tools, its instruments of production. And when those instruments of production changes, society attempts not to change. So society is static. The instruments of production or the economy is in motion. And what happens is that you get a point where something new enters the economic picture. Like today, the fundamental difference is the computerization that entered the process of production. Let me say practically how that happened, because what we often end up is fighting the results of a thing instead of understanding its cause. We've had at least 25 major auto plants close down since 1979. And but it's still an 18 million car market here in the United States. We have had a situation when in the body shop, if you've ever had a chance to go through an auto plant, the body shop is where all the heavy, dirty spot welding used to take place. That's when the body is actually welded together by individuals. We used to have, at Dodge main plant, we used to have 2,000 people in the body shop alone. We organized 6 baseball teams out of that body shop. Today, go through a modern assembly plant, there's not a single human being in the body shop. The entire body shop, the entire spot welding of the body of an automobile is done all by robotics. So you walk through this area and you look, and you just, it's just frightening for us that used to work in those places. And quite naturally, we're happy to see somebody else doing those jobs besides human beings. You know, we're not burn up like we used to be and all of those, but at the same time, we bear the brunt of that, you know, on the social end and the social front of things. I want people to understand the current level of social disruption we are faced with is because of the revolution in production. And the all of the commodities that are socially produced are privately appropriated. That means even though we socially produce these cars, the owner of the plant say, this is my car, I made this. With all of us gone and thrown out of the streets, we can't buy back the commodities that's being produced. We are still an 18 million car market. The automobile industry is one of the best examples. When the first quarter profits were announced this year, after the first quarter in the Big Three, the Chrysler Corporation made a profit because they got the new Chrysler 300 and the Dodge that all the young rappers, Snoop Dogg and all of them are buying. But GM and Ford were hit so hard that they list in the newspaper how many rebates you got. The Freestyle, which is a minivan of Ford Motor Company, now has a $6,000 rebate from the top tag when you buy it. The market is so tight that they can't sell back the commodities they produce, and therefore they got to reduce the amount that they sell it for just in order to move it. And that's so important because even though profit is made in the process of production, it's only realized in sales. So without selling that automobile on the back end, they will not be able to realize the profit that was earned in the process of production itself. And I think in a capsule way, that's how this economy works. The commodity made by a robot has no human labor in it and therefore can't be exchanged. The labor theory of value went like this, that a commodity, its value is based on the amount of necessary labor time that goes into its production. Well, when you have a robot that produces the car, then there's no human labor involved in that, and ultimately it has a tendency to drive the cost of labor back down to zero, which is the kind of the basis of the economic crisis that we're faced with. So when we look up and we see homelessness in the street, hunger everywhere, neighborhoods in disrepair and destruction, no health care. All those things are the results of this fundamental cause of this revolution in the process of production that we're faced with. And oftentimes we so much fighting the effect instead of the cause.
That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. PT Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society, where the current technological advances which create the means for absolute abundance are used to benefit everybody's needs worldwide. If you would like to order PT Radio or other print and media resources, or find out about our speakers bureau, feel free to give us a call at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again is 1-800-691-6888. We're also on the web at www.lrna.org. Once again, I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, thanks for listening, and please join us next time for People's Tribune Radio. Check it.